have to let the leader go. Okay.
And this takes me back to another story that you may not be aware of. I was in, it was about 7 years ago, a scientific conference up in Fairbanks. And we were taking the boat run down to China. And there was a young fellow down there and wanted to strike up a conversation, which we did. And he introduced himself as Harry Lord. Oh, I said, do you have a relative that's a politician up in Barrow? He looked at me, and a little funny. And he says, yes, my uncle is the mayor of the North Slope Borough. And I said, I thought so. And, you know, to just meet somebody, ask that kind of question is a little bit unusual. And, of course, my background. George was born a lord.
A lord?
Yeah.
Huh, okay, and he...
And...
I knew he was adopted, I didn't know.
Yeah, yeah. He's a lord and was adopted by Walton. Of course, Walton's father, you know, was the minister and translator at Wainwright. One of the things you may not have known that the twins are very strong in that family.
The Mohawk family?
Yes.
Oh no, I didn't know that.
Four of the daughters and one of the granddaughters, all with twins.
Really?
Uh-huh. So, for instance, Bobby Fischer.
Yeah.
Twins.
Yeah, they have twins.
And the Thibodeaux.
I don't know the Thibodeaux.
No, they're twins.
They're twins.
But they're four of the sisters, so had a set of twins.
Wow.
And one of the granddaughters. But, and of course, another thing is that you need to know the genealogy at Barrow.
Yes.
And did you know that there had been a genealogy assembled up until about 1970?
Yeah, Edna's genealogy. Yeah.
Except that Edna, I didn't catch it early enough, but Edna made a decision in there that I don't feel should have been made, because if someone left Barrow, then she didn't include them.
Okay.
For instance, as a result, her aunts and uncles, there are seven of them who were not included in the genealogy, and then others who had passed on there are not in that genealogy. And of course you knew that she was a Brower.
Yes.
So, it's, but another thing about the genealogy is that sometimes the, you don't get the relationships. Because, see, in the old culture, you had one name.
Right.
And so when the missionaries, you know, and the bureaucrats became involved, they insisted on at least two, if not three names. And so, for instance, now the and Pharaoh, the it's not so bad any you know anymore. If you want to know, but say that in the earlier period, unless you were native, you didn't know that you weren't supposed to, for instance, marriage. You know, marriage with a relative is total taboo.
Right.
And so, if you didn't know, you wouldn't know this group. For instance, there was one in Nusaninya, and but Ned had four half brothers. All five of them with the same father. And half brothers, Joe Ajak.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Lee Sulu.
Mm-hmm.
Bud Kenayurik. Roscoe Max. He was one that was sort of left town. But the others all up there. So that unless you knew,
right.
And of course in the Nanaktuwit, there's Homer Mikiana,
mm-hmm.
and Vincent Nogciak. I've forgotten the other.
Tigluk?
Or Ajuk?
Was Tigluk one of their brothers?
This I don't know.
Oh, no, he was related to Akuchuk.
Yeah.
Getting mixed up.
But I don't know which the other one. But there, in that case, they're all four brothers.
Right.
So unless you know, well, now, in the genealogy, one doesn't pick up on that.
Mm-hmm.
And then it that's something, but I mean Edna did a real fine job, and of course you know there were not many of those printed.
No.
However, I happen to know where a couple of them are.
And they were that was done through the lab.
Yes, Edna was on staff. And I assigned her the job of doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a job that a man could not do in those days.
Oh, in those days?
Yes. Because there were certain things that the ladies didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
This is, unless... unless you got close, for instance, sometimes that they were relationships that the ladies never knew about because of loss of face.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is no way that a man could gain such insights because his sources would not have opened up.
Mm-hmm.
So that that's one of the things. Well, I know with Harry and Annie, their oldest daughter, Elaine, was wanting to go out and take training as a nurse in South Dakota. And she had gotten an acceptance from the school with the BIA acceptance, which was a little slow in coming.
Mm-hmm.
And so the commissioner, Indian Affairs, Nash, Philly O. Nash, was out on the ship on the North Star, and they couldn't come ashore. And Harry was over and saying that, well, that Elaine had lost her chance to go to school because she had to be there in such and such a date. And that paperwork hadn't come through. So I said, well, Harry, give me a little time. So I got home to the radio people and I sent them a message out to the commissioner. And told him that what it was, that here was a fine prospect to get a native nurse for a barrel, and here the bureaucracy was holding her up. An hour later, in comes a telegram to the BIA to put that girl on the afternoon plane, get her off to South Dakota, and so on. And in those days, there was no airstrip in the village that came to camp. Mm-hmm. So here they come to out to camp, and Elaine comes up to thank me before going to the airplane. She married down there and now lives in Montana. Mm-hmm.
Wait, so you mean Eunice?
Her. Eunice. Okay. Excuse me. Eunice. And, but she's the one that Annie was down visiting one day. And this gets back to the school. And, they had a swimming pool. So Annie decides, well, you know, she can go in swimming. So here she dives off. And here she's lying on the bottom. And she doesn't come up. And she doesn't understand why she doesn't come up to the surface so that she can swim. And she was telling this on herself. And, but then they would send me the Christmas cards. I still have the last card. But I used to kid Harry about the number of grandchildren. And so that last card, I think, has all the youngsters on. It's just got the name of the youngster, and then a number. And, you know, in Harry's own handwriting, and in other words, the subtle humor on him that went over so well. And take, and for instance, on the biological projects, and, you know, Harry would be doing taxidermy and this, that, and the other, because he was so doggone good at taxidermy. The investigators were always down watching him, and they would be talking, and he would be explaining things and telling them about, you know, how things were and so on. And this would, they would pick up the subtle knowledge, and generally the ones that would be talking to him would be the graduate students. And he enjoyed it immensely. And they enjoyed, and then he would tell tales on himself. And there was one time, Harry and Arnold are very interesting. For instance, Arnold was the great hunter provider.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, when he was working at camp, and he worked as a warehouse foreman for years and years. But instead of taking the men home to work,
mm-hmm.
he would, this is during summer, he would walk. And he might shoot five or six seals. on the way to work. Then during the lunch hour, he'd go out, he might get a couple, three more. And then he would walk home at night and get some more. Then get in his vehicle, and he'd drive up and pick up his day's catch. But Arnold, you know, he had to be a real fine provider, because they had 17 children out of 21 pregnancies. And, for instance, his wife said that she never felt better than when she was pregnant. And, I mean, my feeling was that she felt good an awful lot of the time. But the other thing was that Arnold always took 30 days, leaving the, which he was entitled to in the summer. And what he would do is that, you know, these were in sort of the, all the 60s, which were there. He'd take eight of the older kids, and they'd go inland for a couple of weeks. He'd go hunting, and then he'd come back home. And then he'd take his wife, Emily, with the eight youngest. Mm. And they'd go back and do the same thing. Mm. And Arnold hunting the whole time and explaining to the kids the ways of living off the land. And those kids now know. But that was Arnold's approach. And Arnold was very different from Harry. And, you know, Arnold's quite direct. He'll come out and argue with you and sort of jump up and down. And Harry, you know, was so very quiet. And with a subtle sense of humor. Whereas Arnold can sometimes have sort of an angry tone. But anyway, Harry was always trying to teach the young fellows about things. And he'd throw in humor, for instance. Whereas he was not out for hunting like Arnold, Harry was a trapper at heart. And he dearly loved to trap foxes. Well, that for Harry, that was a lot of fun. And I know this after they had power. Harry got Annie an automatic washer. And that year, he caught about 700 foxes. And because he was out every Sunday, and sometimes he'd take an extra day. And you know, Harry could skin a fox without making any more holes in the skin than nature gave. But you know, fox skins to send out, you got to clean them.
Right.
And so he decided, well, automatic washer, that's the way to go. So he put 20 skins in. And put some through the deal. And he ends up with 20 skins with no hair in the washer, pretty well haired up. And he told that story on himself. And just laughed like a bandit. And then he told another time he was out and down there near Wainwright. And he ran into polar bear with two cubs. And so he just sat there in his snow machine. And pretty soon, the cubs sort of wandered over, sniffed around him a bit. And the sow was off at the side. She wasn't making any moves. And Harry wasn't making any moves. And Billy, he gave me, you know, shared lunch with him and so on. And he went back, I think, three times after that. And the cubs were there. And they came over and he shared and he took a little something extra with him. And so I got the story. I saw Annie after that. I said, Annie, I understand that Harry's got a new girlfriend. And she laughed, nah, nah. And I said, yeah, I understand she's got two kids. Yeah, nah, yeah. He says, she's white. And Annie got a little upset with that. And I was kind of getting to her. Then I finally had to own up that they were polar bears. And so it, you know, because as quiet as Harry was, Annie was quite vivacious. And she'd talk up a stream, and she'd get in there and she'd argue, and she ended up on a number of state commissions and this, that, and the other. We got, when I go north, I always went to see him. And Harry normally had one or more grandkids. They run around the house. And, he'd be babysitting in the last couple of years. I think that, well, the question was who was sitting with whom, mm-hmm. and so on. And But last time I saw him, he was, I guess about 2 weeks before she passed away. And dropped in. She heard me. Harry was telling me that she hadn't been out of the bedroom a couple of weeks, you know. It wasn't long. And here Annie came out in her bathroom, and she was puppy, but came out, greeted me warmly, and then this two of us started kidding around. Don't tell no old tales until she got tired. And the two of them made a very wonderful match. And it was this understanding that that Harry had that enabled him to be so influential with the grad students that would come to the lab. He would never tell anybody, you know, of that group. I mean, I sort of doubt it even at home if he'd tell them what to do. But example and gentle persuasion. Well, this, afterwards, you know, they probably know that John Kelly arranged for the award and ceremony. And
I didn't know who it arranged Fairbank. For.
Basically, we should give John Kelly the spark recognition. Mm-hmm. And it was when John brought it up for the discussion with me, I said, John, there should be two. Were he alive? Three. I said, Kenny, Harry, and Pete. They were the ones who made the difference. And in different areas and in different ways. I said, you know, all three of them were teachers. And I said, there is something different with a teacher. I say, lots of people can be in the position of being a teacher, but there are not all that many teachers. And I said, they were. And I said, it's just like in the school system up there. Fred Ippolich was the teacher. And the other one, and on it, Kiva from, it was at Barter Island a long time.
Harold Kavibuk?
Kavibuk. Yes. He was the other. Both of them have schools named after him.
Yep.
But, for instance, my kids, well, John did not have a friend for a teacher. The others did.
Hmm.
And they still say he was the best teacher they ever had. And he used to study under a bed. He'd take a candle to read under the bed.
Wow.
And of course he was recognized as a master teacher.
Uh-huh.
But these other three weren't in the teaching business,
right,
per se.
Right.
They were just teachers.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the recognition then to it fit in the ceremony in Fairbanks, and John and I went up for it.
Did you think about giving one to Pete posthumously, or they don't do that?
I do not know of it in their culture.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the recognition of the building. Oh, by the way, Harold, we put on the school board at Viral, too,
uh-huh,
at the end.
Right.
And, because Shantz, Bobby, of course, was killed, and then Shantz quit the school board. But there was never, to my knowledge, a complaint on the school board. And the school board acted as a buffer between the administration, which there in the 50s and 60s, many of the teachers were from the South.
Still are.
Pardon?
I think they still are.
Oh, you know, Tennessee, Kentucky, down through there. And a lot of them didn't stay long enough to really get to understand people, because it used to be. And if you were up there for a year or so, that by that time, people would either have accepted you or not accepted you. But you were sort of in a neutral position prior to not being there about a year, with the exception if you were a doctor, a nurse, or a minister. That gave you an automatic acceptance. Mm-hmm. Although I have heard complaints about doctors since they finally got them.
Yeah.
And, the other thing, for instance, at an Inalcatuck, and they used to have some mighty fine jumpers at Inalcatucks. But if a native went off or broke an ankle or something like that, they were, you know, laughing and so on. But if a non-native came down straight-legged and sprained an ankle or something, everybody was just a very somber face.
Okay.
You know, their reaction to a native being hurt created a negative impression with some of the early writers because they interpreted it as lack of feeling. And in reality, when it was a non-native that was hurt, it was courtesy because they know that we tend to have long faces if someone is hurt and to be sad. Whereas in the old culture, if something bad happened, you tried to cheer people to make them feel better.
Mm-hmm.
And that, in some of the early writings, that created a negative opinion. It wasn't justified. It's just like at funerals. If non-natives were at, you know, at the gravesite, the people tended to be quite stoic. And yet, John and I have been at funerals where we were the only ones, and an awful lot of sobbing and grief. And in that case, it's not that John and I were native, or that we were white. It was the case that we belonged. And so the people reacted accordingly. That is, I've never seen that well written up, well handled. And another thing that happened, the barrel of the flowers are often buried with the body.
Yeah.
And I know the first time that I saw that, I mentioned it to Kenny. I said, you know, down south, they always put the flowers on top because they want the neighbors to know that you saw a lot of the person. I said, here, when you bury the parts with the body. Those are meant for the person. And I said, maybe that's a lot better than just trying to show the neighbors. When my father was buried, the casket, and I'd mentioned to the funeral director that the family flowers with the body. And so when we went to lower the casket, the assistant director started to reach for the flowers, and the director just pushed his hand away. And then the cover went on. And I was visiting my uncle afterwards. And he mentioned that about the flowers. He said, that's an old Indian custom. I said, well, I didn't know that, but it's an old Eskimo custom. And then I went to, had to explain everything. And the other thing is that, for instance, there are about 40 graves in the Barrow Cemetery that have certain features, head markers on them. The head markers are placed at the same time as the burial. Mm-hmm. We, at the lab, they had a shop for him, and he would make them up a dozen at a time. It got so that at the outlying villages, they'd send in for their head markers. Because they accepted that, but the 6-foot head marker goes down at the same time, 3 feet into the ground. And then the flowers. Shall we say, it's a little modification of the old days, but if you want to get planted, you got to die at Barrow in the winter.
Yeah, I find that. I know that. I hadn't known that for a long time. I just thought everywhere they did it in the winter, because Barrow does it. I was amazed when I found out that Barrow's the only one that does winter burials.
You can't even get buried in the wintertime if you're a U.S. senator. In Fairbanks.
Fairbanks or Anchorage?
Yeah. And Bob Bartlett died on the 10th of December. He didn't get buried until the following June.
Wow. Well, he could have gotten buried in Barrow.
Yep. If he'd
wanted to.
If he'd wanted to in Barrow. In Anchorage now, they dig a few graves in the fall.
Yeah.
But this is at Barrow, and there are other things. They have a saying, we're with the family. That is meant just like it said, mm-hmm. but it is meaning. In other words, with the family. For instance, had I known that I was going to be those years at Merrill, I would have tried to learn Eskimo. It used to be that when they were kids there, and John's oldest daughter and my oldest daughter, about the same age, when there's something that the old folks shouldn't know, they would lapse into Eskimo. Well, knowing kids, and a few words. John and I could usually follow what shenanigans that they were up to.
Right.
But that was the way. And then when the kids, they had 1 year here in Anchorage in school before going on to Juneau when I became commissioner. John and I stopped through coming back from Washington. So, at the house. So John, asking Linda, the oldest girl, what she thought of school here. And she said, okay, I guess. But sure enough, a lot of tonics. It was then that we realized that of all the kids, she was the only one who had never been in class with a white. Huh. And all the rest of them had one or two. Mm-hmm. But not Linda. And she's the one that was the girl that here in a couple of weeks will get a driver's license.
I'm wondering, before Harry worked for the lab, he talked about working on these mapping surveys or something. Do you know anything about that and what he did and where he went?
I can't give you any details. The Coast and Geodetic Survey mapped the coast.
Mm-hmm.
And they, for instance, they put in the all the lot of benchmarks up there, and they mapped the coast from about 46 through 53. And Harry could have been on some of those surveys. But I can't give you any detail.
Yeah, I was. I remember him talking about, he'd always say it as he walked from demarcation to Point Hope.
Mm-hmm.
And I always got the image that it was more in the foothills.
No.
So I was wondering if it was with oil exploration.
No, he wouldn't have. With the oil exploration, because see, at the during the time that Harry was a young fellow, it was the Navy exploration program only up there, and they would go out with weasel parties, and they would go down rivers, because in order to see the geology, you want to see bluffs.
Right.
And so the idea of like walking from Point Hope to demarcation in the through the foothills or that that would not have been the way that they would have approached doing the geology.
Did they have to do any topographic baseline before they did the geology?
Let's put it this way. If you have a map, a topo map, then it's nice to write the geology on it. That's the way things are done today.
Mm-hmm.
But, should we say, in the early days, very often you didn't have maps. In fact, the maps that were made up there were from aerial photography that was flown in 1947 to 49. It's called the Barrex photography. They used 9-lens cameras. And but it was all aerial. And they created the maps from that. But to do the geology, you want to go from start out, say, in the foothills, where you can see the geology, and then try to carry it in the easiest way. And, of course, the way for transportation is down rivers. And in the days when Harry would have been youthful enough to have perhaps been an assistant on one of these programs, it was all down river stuff. And that was done by the Geological Survey for the Navy. In fact, many of my old compatriots were involved in that type of study. I myself never was.
Yeah, I didn't know if you remembered Harry ever talking about it and had...
No, I don't remember Harry talking about such studies. It was, a commander by the name of Max Ricketts that was in charge. But that was all done along the coast. And just mildly inland.
Of the geodetic?
Yeah, geodetic survey. And, but I don't know. And of course, the thing about it is now, see, Harry and Annie were married, I think Harry was 21 and Annie was 20 when they got married. Which would have meant that they got married right after the war. And see, Eunice and Eugene, you know, they wouldn't have been much out of the toddling stage. So it may be that Eugene would have memory of some stories that his dad would have recounted.
Yeah.
Although, in for conversation, and I don't know if you know how well you know the kids.
Pretty well.
Yeah. You know, Charlie's the talkative member of the tribe.
Huh.
And, but in many respects, being very quiet and whatnot, I have a hunch that Ronald might be a real fine source, or even that Harry Jr. A real sensitive type youngster, big tag in Charlie. Harry, you know, might have had a bit more time to chat with him and so on. He's the one that is in Paula's grade.
Right.
And is also the the one that Paula sent. She had a nice photo of Harry, and she sent him a copy.
Mm-hmm.
So it's but she still has. Very, very strong attachment. She, one of the things that surprised her when she went up there, she went, and this was in 87, she went to Wainwright. And, went down with, I think she went with Susie Tulloch. And, went down, and, she was introduced once as Paula Brewer. And she said all the directs of the time that she was there, she was referred to as Max's daughter. And she got a kick out of that.
Yeah. So when did Harry work for the lab? When did you first hire him?
Would be May 1957.
So where I was wondering, what did he do between 44 when he got out of the army and 57?
That's a blank for me.
Okay.
Oh, excuse me. You know, it's when you mentioned the mapping, then I can mention the coast and geodetic. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is that he could have but I'm not sure of this. He could have worked for the Arctic contractors during part of that time. Now, Noah Ida was the number two man in the carpenter shop, the contractor carpenter shop.
For the lab?
No, no, this was for the contractors.
During
the Navy exploration.
Okay.
Noah Ida was number two man there. And I think Noah's dead.
No, he's not.
Oh, he isn't?
Well, last time
I knew of. Yeah. Anyway. For some reason I got me.
He's been quite ill off and on.
For some reason I had gotten the impression that he might be.
I don't believe
then see that during the construction of the new line, this would be 55 and 6, they needed lots of carpenters. So Harry could have worked for that contractor, different from the earlier contractor, in the carpenter shop. The other thing is that in 46, see if 44 to 46, the oil exploration was conducted by Seabees.
Yeah.
And it was only in 46 that the civilian contractor came in. Called it Arctic Contractors, which was a consortium of five companies. Yeah. And so in those days they in effect went over to the village and asked young fellows, young fellows that wanted to work to show up. And then, in effect, what they did was they said, okay, you six, you're carpenter helpers. You six, you're mechanic helpers. And, that sort of an approach. Mm-hmm. And Harry could have worked for the contractors. Now, the other one who worked for the contractors was Eddie Hobson Sr. And so that, but Noah was the number two man there. And see, I think I hired Eddie in 58. And he worked for the lab until about 69 or so. I think it was about then, because I think he had left the lab before I left. And Harry was when hired in 57, he was there continuously.
Until
he retired, which I think was about 76 or no. Yeah, I think it was about 76 when Harry retired. Maybe a little later. But he was there through John's tenure.
Right. So with the Navy was doing the oil exploration, with the Seabees, they still hired local people?
As guides
or something?
Well, for instance, Charlie Edwardson Sr.
Uh-huh.
Was a guide for the original contractors.
So for the Seabees?
For the Seabees, they had some, but essentially it was still, Seabee operation.
Which is official Navy. So that's what I'm wondering, did they hire civilians?
They would, for some things they would have done some hiring.
Okay.
But it was the contractors that really went in.
That's Arctic Contractors?
Arctic Contractors, and made the big difference. So, of course, another one who's very, very cognizant of things in the early history from, you know, like 46 to 50, well, or 45, would be Kenny Tuvok.
Yeah, I need to talk to him.
And now one of the things that you may not be aware of, that Kenny's family was anti the whites from the first one in.
You were anti-white?
Yeah. Huh. And, you know, it's, they weren't sure that up to all that much good. In other words, it's not anti from the ethnic standpoint. But from the standpoint of whether they were up to good. And but then came very much the teachers. And the way, I don't know if you knew that Kenny lost his wife last September. Kenny will be 73 next month, 19th of April. And he is very much the elder. And still, if you need something done, get Kenny.
So, Harry also talked about Peter's Lake.
Yes.
And what did he do out there? That was for you?
Yes. Yes. Harry went over in Peter's Lake. And see, when I had the camps away, Harry constructed Peter's Lake, he constructed Cape Thompson, he constructed the Wanigans at Wainwright, at Mead River, and he was all those places. Harry dearly loved Peter's Lake, and we got a sheep over there, but Harry did excellent work. And I don't know if you've been in Hut 5, the old director's hut in the camp.
Mm-mm.
That beautiful work. Harry and Eddie Hobson. Mahogany.
Wow.
Around the windowsills. And built in glass can. You know where John has his ivory in his
uh-huh.
house? That's a duplicate of what I had at Barrow.
Oh, I thought that was so nice.
Except that mine, because it faced the furnace room,
mm-hmm.
you couldn't see from both sides.
Oh.
Which you can at John's.
Yes. Yeah.
But John's is an exact duplicate of what Harry built. Mm-hmm. And Harry built that at Barrow.
Wow.
And Harry was a finished carpenter and great pride in his work. And I have to think that somehow that Harry worked for Arctic Contractors. Because when I hired him as a carpenter.
Mm-hmm.
And just as I hired Joe Accia as a carpenter. And I knew that Joe had worked for the contractors. But, so I have to put Harry, and this could have spanned some of those years.
Yeah.
But Eddie would know.
Right. I mean, I'd go back and listen to the tapes, which are vague in places. That's why I have all these extra questions. I think he said he worked for Dulai Construction.
Well, see, that would be in the 55, 56 area. When they were turning out, for instance, you know, the Dulai stations, these long trains, those are Wanigans. 28 feet by 20. Those were built in the shop there, in the Quonset shop at Barrow, including all those to the west of Barrow, and those east of Barrow, clear to the Mackenzie River. They were built in the shop in those sections, hauled out to the location, put in the piling, and, you know, just like putting boxes together.
It's amazing.
And, for instance, the main stations, there are 26 units, I've forgotten what we call them, but Wanigans, you know, is as unit, but 26 sections long. In other words, 520 feet.
Do you have to answer that phone, or your wife is going to? Okay.
Those were there, and they, during that period, they had about 700 people in camp.
During the Dulai?
During Dulai construction, that was maximum, because they had some of them in tents on the beach.
Wow.
Now, during the Navy exploration period, the maximum number of people at the Navy were the contractors and up there. Was all 300, 350, and essentially the camp, as it was constructed in those days, had a capacity of about 350.
At the end of this tape, too.